Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. It's Friday, which means that we're almost at the weekend. And my newsletter this morning says, you know, we talk about the split screen world that we live in. And it does feel that way. And I keep thinking of these various images, the image of my home state of Wisconsin, all the people who came out and went to the bars, no social distancing, no masks, that moment where you realized, okay, they're just done with the whole pandemic. And then the split screen of the former head of the effort to come up with a vaccine for this pandemic, Dr. Bright, whose testimony before Congress yesterday was bleak, saying that we are faced with one of the worst winters ever if we don't get our act together. So you have half of America deciding it's time to party, it's all over, we're not going to take this serious anymore. And one of the most compelling whistleblowers I've heard in a very long time warning the country, we are not ready for this. So that's one split screen. The other split screen being that we wake up today, there are 85,000 Americans that have died from this pandemic. We have more than 30 million Americans who may be out of work or have applied for unemployment compensation. The public is increasingly skeptical of the way the federal government has handled all of this. And what do we have? We have the alternative reality of Obamagate and the unmasking controversies. And I have a screenshot, and I think it was put together by Oliver Darcy from CNN, from Fox News, of their obsession with that story. So in terms of split screen, while CNN and MSNBC are focusing on this this extraordinary testimony by Dr. Bright yesterday, we have gone down the rabbit hole of a completely different story. So who better to talk about our split screen universe than our own Bill Kristol. Bill, thanks for coming back on the podcast. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Charlie. I thought you were going to say, who better to talk about going down rabbit holes than Bill Kristol?
Well, we could. And by the way,
sure, that's my greatest qualification, but I'm happy to discuss it. And I also like the fact that in your introduction, you said it was Friday, and you know, we're entering the weekend. It's interesting. It's good that you still have that concept of the week and the weekend, because I've got to say, for some of us here, it's been kind of obliterated as each day is kind of the same as the next.
It's funny you would say that, because yesterday I had a discussion with my wife about whether I was absolutely convinced it was Wednesday yesterday. I was completely convinced, and I got an email or a text message saying, hey, you know, there's a new episode of Mrs. America on whoever's broadcasting this. And I thought, that's interesting that they would have dropped it a day early, because it usually comes out on Wednesday. And apparently I was completely disoriented about what day of the week it was. So, you know, we have to find our ways of our handholds to get through the week. By the way, you've been doing TV via Skype, right? From home?
Yeah.
And so there's a guy who rates the rooms, who actually gives a score of 0 to 10 on how your study, or in my case, my kitchen looks. And it was Ben Wittes still, I think, has the only perfect score. I don't follow it religiously. I mean, I do look at it, because what else do we have to do other than to have some rando anonymous guy on Twitter coming up with metrics? But Ben Wittes actually got a 0 out of 10, because it looks like an Al Qaeda. Honestly, it's the blue wall looks like an Al Qaeda hostage video. So do you know what your rating is, Bill?
I think he rated me. I think it's Claude Taylor and his wife who do it. There have been a couple of good articles about it, actually. You know, people who interviewed him and his wife and others who were victims or objects of it. He's witty. That's why it's worth reading. I think, like everything else, it was very funny at first, because it was truly just people were just doing these things on Skype and not thinking much about the background. I certainly wasn't. I did it from my somewhat messy, or I would say lived in, study with, you know, books and papers in the bookcases, somewhat, you know, stacked up and so forth. And he made some joke about that, and that got a little, you know, currency on online. I've since actually taken all the advantage of all these days at home to clean up things a little bit, but is that what I want to reassure people. But anyway, he's now, of course, people are like, you know, trying to get good grades and taking his advice on bringing plants, which has kind of ruined the point of it, right? I mean, now it's become sort of competition to, you know, bring some nice art and some plants in and have some perspective on your Skype call. So like everything else, it's sort of, you know, it's great at first and maybe a little less great now, but it's still kind of amusing.
It's, yeah, now it's become performance. Well, so the other day I was on and I got a six out of 10 because, I don't know, I guess the shot was too narrow and you couldn't see anything. So I thought 6 out of 10 was just completely fine. I am completely okay with that. I mean, as long as I can do a television hit without having to wear, you know, real pants. I mean, I wear, you know, sweats and stuff. You know, I'm happy with that. But my wife was really concerned about it. So she went out into the garden. And she actually picked flowers and arranged them very, very carefully in a vase, like behind me, and then tried to, and then took a picture and said, try to get the frame like this. She took it seriously. And late last night, we got a rating of 8.0 out of 10 with a specific shout out to the nice flowers. So you want to talk about validation.
That makes it all worthwhile. You know, he's a sucker, or they're a sucker of the dog, who isn't, I guess. But you have all those massive and attractive dogs.
I know.
So, I mean, you should get them somehow in the shot. Of course, it might disrupt the actual TV interview a little bit if they start.
Yeah. That's the problem. The dogs are extremely photogenic, but to say mixing live television with large German shepherds may be problematic.
No risk, no glory, Charlie. You know?
Well,
go for it. I mean, Brian Williams will be making an intelligent trying to ask you an intelligent question, and they'll start to go crazy. It'll be huge.
Yeah, my wife, we did discuss this. Now, the cute dog is the puppy, of course. And that would be awesome. That would get me a higher score. However, he would probably bite me during the break because he's teething. He's got these sharp little needly teeth. And so that would be a little awkward. Hey, speaking of Brian Williams, our colleague Tim Miller was on Brian Williams last night during the 11th hour. And Tim has done yeoman service trying to explain the weird conspiracy theories out there. I know that there are some people who think that Yoda will ignore weird conspiracy theories. You know, let's not talk about QAnon. Let's not talk about these weird things because that just gives them more oxygen. You know, I completely disagree with that. I think it's important to expose them and to actually confront them because the reality is they're out there in the world, aren't they? I mean, we have a president who is giving more traction to weird, batshit crazy theories than we've ever experienced before. So the whole, hey, let's just ignore this stuff doesn't seem to work, does it?
No, I think you're right. I mean, they seep into the discourse and people who aren't paying huge attention. You know, I think I've seen this a couple of focus groups I've watched from a distance here. You know, people who haven't been paying close attention to Joe Biden and to the issues in the race and so forth. They get some vague sense of, oh, wasn't there something wrong there? And
yeah.
So if Trump's done some things wrong, but kind of the Obama-Biden people did some things wrong. And so, you know, it's kind of a wash. And so it does, you know, it doesn't affect 90% of the voters, but does it affect 2, 3, 4, 5% if one of these things gets enough credibility to be kind of passed around out there and online? Sure. So I think it's important to deal with them both the way Tim does so terrifically in that piece on The Bulwark, which people should go read, where he just explains how crazy the theory is, what would have to be true to believe in this theory. And it's just ridiculous. To the degree it's even a coherent theory at first. I'm also struck by the, you know, what Trump's political intention, to the degree he's got one, and to the degree he's not just throwing stuff out there, you know, is in resurrecting or creating this whole, trying to create this narrative at this time.
Yeah. So let me just play a little clip from Tim, who's trying to explain this and tries to explain it in 2 minutes. And of course, he does recommend that you're probably better having a glass of scotch before you try to get into this mentality. But here's Tim Miller from the Brian Williams Show last night.
Hey, Brian, thanks for having me. I hope your viewers have a nice peaty scotch with them, because this is kind of complicated to understand. Obviously, the president, as he showed there, doesn't even understand what it is. But the thing is there is a conservative media ecosystem that is very dedicated to trying to explain this quote-unquote scandal. And more damningly, the Department of Justice is looking into this scandal. And so our tax dollars are being paid to look into this conspiracy theory. So in short, there are two parts to it. One is pre-2016 election. This is the really wacko part, trying to convince Americans that actually the Russians did not interfere in the election on behalf of Donald Trump, but there was an international deep state coup and an inside job at the DNC that was overseen by President Obama and others to frame Russia and frame Donald Trump in an attempt to hurt Trump in the election. The problem with that part of the conspiracy theory is, Donald Trump won the election and they didn't do anything or release anything about, the Russian interference before the election in a way that could have damaged him. So that part is so far out there that even many in the conservative media won't buy on with it. And so the second part of the scandal, a quote unquote scandal, is what happened after the election. And that is this claim that the deep state basically tried to undermine President Trump. Judge Jeanine has gone so far as to call it a coup by creating a lot of false investigations about the Russian interference into the election in an attempt to get Trump, President Trump, impeached and removed. And that's based on some very, very dodgy information indeed. But the most alarming part of it is this little drip, drip, drip of information that's coming out is coming from the Trump Director of National Intelligence, Richard Grenell, who has had no experience for this job, was a Twitter troll mostly before this. And now, he's releasing little nuggets of information to give, the right wing media enough to make it seem like there's a scandal here when there's not. And I think that is why we need to look at this seriously, even though the claims are ridiculous.
Oof. Bill Kristol, yeah, that his comment about Rick Grenell and the way that Rick Grenell is using this intelligence to score political points is I think kind of an underappreciated point here. I mean, if the whole scandal is that, look, the Obama folks politicized intelligence to go get their enemy. Well, that's what's happening in real time. And it's another example of this Trumpian projection, isn't it?
Yeah, the scandal is what's happening now, much more than anything that seems to have happened in December, January of 2016 or January 2017. From what we know, a bunch of people requested the unmasking, the finding out someone who'd been intercepted in a conversation. It looks like the main one was in mid-December. They must, I take it, I'm just guessing here, but I was in government at the time. So I'm the intelligence services circulated to senior policymakers some document that had an unidentified American. That's the way they're supposed to do it to preserve privacy. Conversing with a foreigner, maybe Russian, maybe Turkish, since Flynn had so much was being paid a ton by the Turkish government, basically, right, during the campaign, about something. And people were pretty alarmed, because it looks like separately, they all said, who is, we need to know who that is, because to make a better judgment of how serious a counterintelligence situation we have. And that was Flynn, apparently. So that's what happened. And no one leaked. I mean, there were eventually some leaks, but nothing happened to, disqualify Flynn. Nothing, of course, was after the election. There was nothing. So Obama counseled President Trump that he shouldn't hire Flynn as national security advisor. There was no secret that the Obama people thought, just as a matter of judgment, that Flynn was not a great choice. So the whole scandal is sort of a nothing burger. But the real scandal is what's happening now in May 2020 with the Director of National Intelligence purposely revealing, I don't know how sensitive it is, who asked for this thing, but it's not the kind of thing you're usually release. And why to classify it? It was no importance at all, but he gives it to the, no reason the public needed to know. There are thousands. I think in the Obama administration, there have been 10,000 requests, I read somewhere last year, for unmasking. It's a pretty routine thing.
You mean in the Trump administration?
I'm sorry, the Trump administration.
Yeah.
So, anyway, the whole thing is the scandal is what's the politicization of intelligence now. I do think if you think about what's behind it, I think it's, Tim touches on this. I think it's important. I mean, one doesn't want to overthink what Trump does, and a lot of it is just, throwing water at the wall and so forth. But if you just think going forward, Trump has had a huge interest in debunking the Russia hoax, right? And he collapses together. Mueller didn't quite find criminal proof of collusion to, was there actually Russian interference at times? Trump has, of course, denied that or expressed skepticism about it. It's all sort of one big hoax. And I think the reason he wants to do that, and the reason he's got Grinnell doing the stuff now and Barr doing some stuff too, is he wants to be in a situation in September and October to, if people say, wait a second, it looks like there's an awful lot of Russian interference again. It's not like the Russians couldn't do it again, right? Say, no, that was a hoax then. It's a hoax now. I'm very worried about it. Greg Moore had a good piece in The Atlantic on this. Some people are sort of treating the Russia thing as a past tense story. You know, that happened in 2016, but like, couldn't it happen in 2020? And do we have confidence that the Trump administration will do a lot to call attention to it, to call Putin off it, to respond if appropriate, to let Congress know, to let the public know? And this is an indication to me that Trump, in fact, is ahead of time trying to delegitimize someone who might say, from someone who's studying this stuff at a think tank or whatever, you know, hey, we've got a lot of evidence of Russian trolls trying to spread misinformation or disinformation this time in 2020. So I think, to the degree there's a method to his madness, I think it is an attempt to lower the bar to Russian interference.
It works on several different levels, and you're right. Don't attribute deep strategic thought to the president. Actually, I really liked Susan Glasser's piece in the New Yorker, where she says, "Look, this is not necessarily going after Obama is not a genius move. This is really his safe space. You know, for Trump, spending the week attacking Obama is the political equivalent of retreating to his bedroom and hiding under the blanket. It's his safe space, his comfort zone." I think that's true. But I also think your point about essentially giving a green light in many ways to the Russians, you want to come in here, we're not going to be fighting all of that, which also raises the question with all of the things that are going on. You know, what's going on with Chris Wray? You know, he's kept his head down. But if you watch the Trump world media ecosystem, it's always an interesting leading indicator because it's a feedback loop, isn't it? I mean, you know, it's not that Trump leads them. Well, sometimes he does, but sometimes he will pick up the themes. And so you knew that Fauci was pretty much on the way out when the Trump ecosystem turned against him. And now there's all this, you know, fire Chris Wray. How could you be the head of the FBI at a moment when the president just on a regular basis, the president and his allies on a regular basis attack and demean and slime the work of the FBI?
Yeah, I mean, I think you make two important points. The first is the whole media conservative, if that's Trumpist media ecosystem. I think you're right. They're a leading indicator, partly just because they are, you know, conspiratorial Trump supporters. And so they're willing to say things that Trump isn't quite willing to say yet, or they're willing to speculate on things that there's no evidence at all about. Not that that always stops Trump. But I also think they talk all the time. What's really clear is, and we talked when I was in government to the press some and tried to get them to perhaps, you know, explore some issues that we weren't quite ready to float yet, or suggest, you know, to try a balloon. Isn't that what that term means? You know, just see how a policy might play. But we're so far beyond that in terms of the ways in which senior Trump officials and senior Trump campaign people speak to people at Fox News and elsewhere. And I think it's quite explicit. And, you know, why don't you take a look at, you know, this, or what about attacking that guy? I think he's doing terribly. We probably can't say it quite yet, but why don't you lay the groundwork? So I do think it's very appropriate as a kind of analytical matter in trying to understand the current political situation to treat the Trump administration, the Trump campaign, Fox News, you know, Trumpist Twitter, all as one big organization, in a sense, loosely held together, but held together. And so it's perfectly fair, as you just did, to sort of say, is this kind of a leading indicator? And I don't know if he's going to fire Chris Wray, but is he intimidating Chris Wray from speaking up a little bit? Is he getting the FBI to kind of not object to doing some things that maybe it should be objecting to? Look, the actual, remember this too, I mean, despite all this fluffing about the NSA, the National Security Agency, and the demasking, it was apparently an FBI intercept or FBI knowledge, let's just say, that led to the questioning of the FBI's own questioning of Flynn, right? I mean, the whole Kislyak thing is an FBI thing, it seems like, more than an NSA thing. So it doesn't hurt Trump to have the FBI somewhat discredited, but somewhat intimidated, or the FBI director, at least, somewhat intimidated. The FBI, as we saw in 2016, can make a big difference. I mean, when Jim Comey came out 10 days before the election, he intended to particularly elect Trump, but obviously the reopening of that email investigation against with Hillary was a big moment. And so Trump is well aware of the political role the FBI can play, sometimes purposely and sometimes more by just keeping it quiet or encouraging it to do something for other reasons that they don't fully understand. Yeah, so I think it's a very important thing to keep a close eye on what happens with the Justice Department and the FBI. And, you know, let's keep an eye on Chris Wray.
All right, let's talk about the pandemic, where we're at right now. At this moment, the House is about to pass a $3 trillion piece of legislation that's really going nowhere. So I, to be quite honest, I haven't been paying that much attention to it because it feels like we're going to go through that normal kabuki dance. We'll come up with something at the end. But give me your sense of the state of play, because, you know, clearly the economy has imploded. We are talking in terms of Great Depression numbers, in terms of the gross domestic product, in terms of the number of Americans who are out of work. We are over 85,000 dead Americans. Even the president is conceding it's going to be into six figures. His approval ratings have taken a hit, but basically they're where they were. So even as the country, the vast majority of voters say, they don't believe the president anymore. They don't think he handled this appropriately. You're not seeing a big Joe Biden surge. So, but give me your sense of where we are at right now. Where do you see the trend lines?
Yeah, I actually had a long conversation with Mike Murphy a couple of days ago, which people can look at it in conversations with Bill Kristol or actually listen to. We did it.
It's outstanding.
Socially distanced way. So it's a podcast, but a good one. I've got to say, and Mike's a shrewd observer, as you know, of all this. Mm-hmm. So I asked him, isn't it sort of striking that, Trump is kind of where he was 3 months ago, despite a pretty historic mismanagement of a crisis. And isn't this where how presidents are usually judged on how they manage the one, two, or three big crises of their term? I mean, one point to make is the rally around the flag effect would have helped Trump. It did help Trump clearly for a while. That seems to have subsided, but, you know, it probably gave him a little bit of a boost. But also, I think he's betting. He doesn't think this is a winning issue for him anymore. Clearly, that's why he's talking about Obamagate. He wants to try to fight this to something close to a draw, where people say, "Look, I mean, everyone's kind of messed this up. He kind of messed it up too at first, but he kind of got it together, and you know, at least he wanted to open up again and help us get back to normal, and he cared about the economy, not just about, you know, New York City and the places where the virus was really terrible." And they're betting a huge amount, obviously, on the opening up going reasonably well and not leading to a huge spike. But if there are some little spikes, I suppose they'll rationalize those in terms of the virus. They're hoping for a bounce in the economy. They'll get a tiny bounce now just because it can't go lower and because there's going to be some opening up. So there'll be a little more business, presumably. But I think, I mean, Michael Strain of AEI has a good piece on this, that, you know, you could also have a situation where you get a little bounce, people get a little confident or complacent, and then it really collapses in the fall. So anyway, Trump knows, I suppose, that all this stuff is hard for him to manage at this point. What's done is done. I mean, I think he's being terribly irresponsible and not being much more urging people to be cautious and prudent about the virus itself. And he doesn't have the tests and he doesn't have the PPE and so forth. But given that, I think he's just betting on kind of playing the coronavirus to a draw and then throwing enough mud on the Obamagate type stuff and Biden's, you know, alleged, you know, goofiness or quasi senility or whatever, and sort of, you know, discredit Biden enough to stagger to a narrow victory. I think that's their theory of the election.
Well, do you think it's correct?
I think it's unlikely, because I think at the end of the day, this event is so big. And I think his mismanagement of it is so serious and pretty obvious. And I don't think it's going to get much better, unfortunately. It might get a little better and then a little worse by election day, that I think it will tend to swamp all the election tactics. Having said that, given that he's not fixing the way he's dealt with the way he's dealing with the virus, he's not fixing the government at all. As you say, that testimony by Dr. Bright yesterday is pretty
stunning.
Terrible. Trump, yeah. Stunning. And, you know, so that's not changing. Apparently, he's in fact sidelining Fauci and those, and others who are trying to be very responsible and serious. I guess, you know, maybe from his point of view, it's as good a tactic as, you know, it's a reasonable shot at victory. And I come back to what I was mentioning a minute ago, and you and I have discussed before. And I do think, I worry that people are still underestimating the degree to which he'll be willing to go to invite foreign interference, weaponize parts of the federal government from the Justice Department through the intelligence community to other parts, you know, and really just try to create such chaos and sort of havoc, and also, you know, impressions of corruption on the other side, and reward his friends, reward businesses in states that are swing states to open up, even if it's risky, because it look good, you know, on November 3rd. I mean, I just think the degree to which he's going to do that might have some effect. I tend to think reality will prevail, but you can't always bet on that.
No, you can't bet on it. And I think, you know, keeping raising that question of what is he prepared to do? If he's 10 points behind in the polls in September or October, what is he capable? What other cards will he play? How far will he push the levers of government? And it feels like how high is up type question, given his propensities. So Karl Rove apparently said that, look, most presidents in a bad economy are going to lose. But if the economy is coming back in the third quarter, the voters will give him credit for that. They'll give him credit for the trajectory rather than the fact that we still probably will have double digit unemployment. Is he with? Now, of course, there are other reports that Karl Rove went to the White House and told Trump that he's on track to lose this election. So we don't know what Karl is saying in public and private. But what about the giving him credit if it looks like we're headed in the right direction?
Yeah, and if he can convince people that everyone took a huge hit, that wasn't his fault, and indeed he was sort of fighting inside the government and outside for opening up faster. I think that's why. That was the method to the madness of the open up, liberate, you know, Minnesota kind of craziness, Michigan, whatever kind of craziness, that he wanted to be on the side of opening, the side of the economy, the side of allegedly helping middle America against, I guess, you know, old people and people who are suffering from the disease. It does position him, I suppose, to take a little bit advantage of that. I do think one thing to think about, I was talking with someone yesterday who's involved in professional sports, in the management side. And, you know, it'll be the whole August, September timeframe. I mean, that's where the rubber hits the road. We can have an awful lot of gradual and responsible opening over the next month or two. We can have a lot of irresponsible opening, like what we saw in Wisconsin and that bar. We'll have a whole mix of these things. There'll be some effects. Some effects will be disguised. Some things won't have as much of an effect as people think. Other things will. You know, these things they're so short-term oriented these days that, you know, a place opens up, right, nothing happens for 3 days, and everyone says, well, see, it didn't, you're not paying any price, as if the disease doesn't take two weeks, you know, as 3 weeks to show it to manifest itself, its effects. But anyway, but think about September, about August, September. You have two huge things, I think, happening. Schools and universities. I mean, I think the mood of the country psychologically will be very different if we're sort of back to normal. Obviously, it's not going to be entirely normal at K-12 or universities. You know, there'll be some teachers teaching remotely. There'll be there'll be much less mixing in the dormitories. There'll be new precautions with, you know, the dining halls and the cafeterias. You can imagine it'll all be kind of a mess and a little different. But if people have the sense of it's on the road back to normalcy, that probably helps Trump and probably would generally give people a sense of confidence that this thing is, you know, a big hit, obviously, to us in terms of health and the economy and so forth. But we're sort of getting past it. If it turns out if there's another bit of a resurgence, or if it just turns out to be too complicated or too difficult or uneconomic to open up, then I think you're looking at a very different psychological situation. So, you know, there are a lot of kids, 40 million kids are in K-12, another 10 million or something. I don't know, maybe it's not quite that many in college, and got, you know, parents and relatives and teachers and bus drivers and, you know, staff at these schools. I mean, there's a huge number of people involved in this in education in America. And so is that sort of functioning sort of normally or not? I think that's I don't have a view right now even on what the right answer is. It's obviously very complicated. My instinct is it's going to be harder to open up than people think, both for universities, K-12, but also for businesses, just because people are being a little simple-minded about the opening up thing. It's not, if a restaurant opens up and has 20% of the business, it loses more money than if it's just closed, probably. So you know what I mean? It's not like you can just sort of, it's not like it's all a net plus to have wildly underutilized assets. Same with, you know, hotels and many, many other things. So I think people haven't really thought through the implications of just the natural tendency to be very cautious, the prudence of being very cautious, certainly if you're over 60 or have different conditions and so forth. So I'm without a vaccine. I mean, again, it will change if there are good therapeutics at that point or not. So awful lot of wild cards, I guess, is around August, September. The next 2 months, I suspect, will be a lot of incremental things and zigs and zags, and the state's not doing well, and the state is going in this direction. I doubt if there'll be, well, who knows, but it seems to me it may well not be anything really definitive, you know? But I do feel like by Labor Day, it'll sort of be clear that we're at least trying and to come out of it in a pretty big way, and Trump will go visit places and go to a college football game, even if there's only a quarter of the stands are full, and go to, you know, when schools will be beginning, or not. And if it's the not, then I think we're in a very different place, sort of psychologically.
No, I agree. And of course, it would be the fall if you were going to have a resurgence of this when it would start to happen. So you even take that line into October, because if you look at the history of, say, the Spanish flu, it came back in the fall when, you know, the temperatures go down. But you're right, in a couple of points there. The people need to be reminded that it wasn't the shutdown orders that killed the economy. It was the pandemic itself. I mean, people are afraid to go out. They're not going to restaurants. And here in Wisconsin, I think you're going to get an interesting microcosm, because you have, you know, the Supreme Court threw out all the rules and people went back to the bars and they're fist bumping and they're not social distancing and they're not wearing masks. But we had a poll last week here in Wisconsin, and only about 25% of the public says they're comfortable going to a concert, a sporting event, or some other large-scale event. Fewer than half, I think only 42%, said that they were willing to go back to a restaurant. So simply declaring it's open for business doesn't change anything if people are worried about the pandemic, which they still are. And there's a lot of surveys indicating that people are still concerned about their health. And I have to say, the no mask, let's all go and drink at the bar thing is actually counterproductive for people who want to reopen the country. Because I'm sitting here in Wisconsin today, and I could go, you know, outright. We're free. We've been liberated. But when I see the kind of the moron behavior of some of these folks, it makes me less likely to want to go out. I mean, I would be willing to go out to a restaurant at some point when I think that everybody is behaving with maximum social responsibility, but we're not seeing that. So we have these cross currents right now, and we have no idea how it's going to play out in the months before the election. None.
I think that's such an important point. I mean, if we had a president and a federal government, and of course state governments as well, but if the federal government were taking the lead in encouraging responsible behavior, in saying, look, we, as a prudent matter, wear a mask, not if you're by yourself, yeah, not if you're 20 feet away from everyone, perhaps outside, but any place you're going to run into people closely, certainly restaurants or bars, whatever. A, B, of course, we want social distancing in terms of the restaurant owners and the bar owners doing that. C, we're really crashing on the testing. We're really going to try to make it possible for you, Charlie Sykes, to, you know, have a do-at-home test to make sure you haven't caught anything. And also, more importantly, to enable restaurant owners and others to say, hey, test yourself before you come here, or conceivably have the thermometer at least at the door to test people, even though you then run into the problem of some asymptomatic people, but it's better than nothing.
Right.
Again, if we had PPE.
It's reassuring. So yeah, right.
Yeah, if we had PPE, so people could wear masks more easily or get them for free, perhaps, or again, people who are in more dicey situations get some other coverings. If, again, then on the drugs, if one had a, there, I think they're doing a little better, it's the private sector mostly, but even there, if one had a real sense of a crash program to get some stuff so that we really had a sense that if something unfortunately happened, you're in better shape than you would have been 2 or 3 months ago in terms of hospital care and medical care. If all of that were happening, I think you would actually, the irony is you would have more of an opening up. I very much agree with that, especially the mask thing is so revealing. I mean, for Trump to be irresponsible on masks is the craziest thing in the world. If you think they should care about actually opening up, if you think they want to care about fighting a culture war,
right,
blaming the public experts and liberals for what's happened they kind of think, look, it's going to be kind of terrible out there, so we can't win on the basis of reality. So let's win on the basis of, you know, disliking experts or something. Then I suppose their behavior is rational, and it's clear to me, therefore, that that's what they think. They're not. I mean, that's what's so amazing. People say, well, why are you so upset with Trump? It's kind of been difficult elsewhere. Governors have made mistakes. Obviously, Cuomo was very slow in New York. De Blasio ruled as a head. But, and you know, De Blasio, really awful, the city.
It's terrible.
And even Cuomo late. But it's one thing to be late and then adjust and at least try to, like, help people, though. Trump really, and the Trump supporters, aren't interested in any empirical argument about, you know, what would help open things up faster, and therefore people might want to wear more masks, even if they personally don't believe they need it or in the science. But it's so obvious from the Trumpists that for them, this is all some, you know, proxy culture war. It's really amazing.
No, it is, and it's completely irrational. And we've had some good stuff in the Bulwark about this, and I don't know him, Rusty Reno, the editor of First Things, who went on this Twitter tirade saying that people who wear masks are cowards, you know, and unlike the soldiers in World War II, you know, it's sort of an indication that did you lack courage, which is, of course, ridiculous on so many grounds. I mean, number one, did he never read a book or see a movie about World War I? Did he never understand that people, in fact, did wear masks? And number two, the fact is you wear the mask so that you will not infect other people. It doesn't necessarily protect you, but it protects other people. It is an act of profound unselfishness to do it. So to illustrate this point, imagine, you know, getting on an airplane. I don't know if you've flown much lately, but I mean, this is going to be a real problem, I think, getting the airline industry back up. The airlines have figured out that in order to get people to come back in, you're going to have to require them to wear masks. Now, there's some questions about whether they require you to keep it on. But I mean, think about getting on an airplane, which they say, okay, first of all, we're going to take your temperature. We assure you that we have absolutely cleaned this airplane. We're not going to have any middle seats, so we're going to do the most we can for social distancing, and everybody has to wear a mask. I mean, those are the kinds of things that might encourage a lot of people to get back on the airplane. Now, imagine getting on that airplane, and you have some guy come in, you know, wearing the t-shirt, the red hat, saying, screw these masks, freedom, nobody's going to tell me what to do, I'm going to do, you know, is that going to enhance your confidence about flying? Is that going to make you want to be on that airplane with that guy or not? So that's the whole irrationality of what we're seeing right now.
Totally agree. And I'll give you one instance, because I was talking to someone who's involved in the management ownership side of sports. So think of sports arenas. They're probably, if they open up, they'll have to sort of have a kind of distancing and sell only half the seats or a third of the seats or a quarter of the seats. And that's got its own economic challenges or whatever. But this fellow pointed out to me something. You could imagine that working, though, I guess. And then people wearing masks, or maybe not, even if they're outdoors and they're 6 feet from everyone else and not sneezing and stuff. But you would certainly be more comfortable, I would be, if other people were wearing masks in that kind of environment with, you know, thousands of people there, even if it's only a quarter full or half full. But then think of his point was, well, you know, that will work okay. But what about the beginning and the end of the game? You can't really tell people, or it's hard to tell people, you know, spread out your arrival at the University of Wisconsin games from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. so there's not congestion at the gates, right? And the way these arenas are built, at the end of the day, there are only X number of entrance points, you know, maybe a half dozen or something. And there's going to be a lot of people milling around at 12:55 p.m. if there's a 1 p.m. game getting in through the turnstiles, right? There's no real way to fix that or change that. And the same at 4 p.m. when the game ends. So then you really will feel more comfortable going to a game, I think, if everyone's wearing a mask, if people have been told to stay home if they have any symptoms or feel sick, if people have been encouraged to self-test or get a test, if that's easy to do at that point, if there were enough tests. That's where I do think the prudent and even cautious public health attitude would, of course, encourage more people to get up and go out. Than the opposite. But it is sort of amazing. I think the serious governors understand that, incidentally, and are kind of trying to balance Larry Hogan in Maryland, relax some of the stay-at-home rules, because most of Maryland's in decent shape. But again, he did it with a lot of this advice and caution that we've been talking about. But that's not what you hear from the federal government.
Okay, so you got a lot of...
You hear from some people in the federal government.
Right. Okay. Well, you, Bill, got a lot of attention this week. Not that you don't always get attention, being the media giant that you are. But there was an interview that was published in the Washington Post. I guess it's an excerpt from a book on activists. in which you were asked about whether you can still see yourself going back to the Republican Party. And I found this very interesting because the last time I heard you weigh in on all of that, I mean, you've kind of waged this, I think, sort of quixotic effort to save the Republican Party, saying that, look, we need to have two rational Republicans. Now, you wrote a piece, Why I'm Still a Republican. But you were asked, are you able to go back then, or do you see yourself permanently outside the party? And your answer was, I don't think going back is really plausible. 3 years ago, I was using the rhetoric, the terminology of going back to, or saving, or restoring, those kinds of words. But Trump's been renominated, and liberating the party from Trump or Trumpism seems awfully far-fetched. Obviously, if he loses, things are more in flux. Maybe there are more opportunities. But I cannot honestly conceive of working with Mitch McConnell and John Cornyn and Kevin McCarthy. I'm just disgusted by what they've been doing, really, for the last 3 years, and I don't much look forward to that. So you've changed your mind.
I think I have some. Just to be clear, so this is an interview that will be in this Sunday's Washington Post. The Washington Post magazine, like many Sunday papers do or did, and they have a feature pretty much every week, I think. One page, it's called Just Asking or Asking Questions, something like that. KK Otteson, a good reporter at the Post, has been doing it the last few years. She also has this book called Activists. That's what you're thinking of there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And it's got a couple of photos and, you know, this edited down transcript. I spoke to her on the phone for about half an hour or a month ago. She came out and we practiced social distance. She took a couple of photos. I don't know. We'll see what those look like on Sunday.
It's a very nice photo, at least online.
That was outdoors in our front yard. And then she took a couple. She thought this would capture the moment of me sitting in the living room, I guess, you know, through the window. So that'll be very high art. She's a good photographer. I mean, she did this for a living. So it'll be a very high concept photo. Anyway, long way of saying there's this one pager in the Washington Post Sunday magazine. They put it online Tuesday, Wednesday, and as you say, got a little attention. And that's where that quote is from. So, and she did a good job, I'd say, of reducing a longish conversation to some, I think, reasonable sounding, paragraphs and highlights. Yeah, I mean, I guess I have maintained and still think, you know, that in principle, of course, having two rational parties is better than not. And you don't want to, would have been a mistake to prematurely, but I at least thought I didn't want to prematurely give up on the Republican Party. You know, but we made a lot of efforts, whether it was in 2018, 2019, 2017, 18, 19, to see if there were ways to separate Republican federal office holders, Republican state office holders, Republican voters from Trump. Maybe we didn't do a good job. Maybe others didn't, but we certainly didn't succeed. Trump has a pretty firm headlock on the party. I mean, I don't think it would be crazy to say that after November 3rd, if he loses or maybe loses badly, maybe there'll be real rethinking. But I'm pretty dubious, honestly, even about that. And then what she was sort of asking more of a personal question. And I just personally am so, can I imagine 8 years from now, some person who's now 23 and is then 31 running as a Republican, and he'd be great. And I'd say, hey, that's a great candidate. Let's all support him. Sure, I don't have like a dogmatic theological position on the word Republican. Can I imagine working with the actual office holders who've been so much enablers of Trump and apologists for Trump? I just can't, honestly. And maybe things will change and we'll all forget things 2 or 4 or 6 years from now. But I can't. State level is a little different, but say you do have actual governors and even some, you know, others, elected officials who are being responsible and have kept a little more, obviously because they're state office holders, have been able to keep a little more distance. And I may be overreacting because I'm here in D.C. and so I see the federal stuff, and that's where the most shameful and shameless enabling and apologizing has taken place. But anyway, so I'm very open-minded about what happens after November 3rd. Honestly, I really do think it's an interesting moment. It's worth really thinking in a fresh way about politics and party divisions and party allegiances and even policy questions, because obviously some of the old solutions of right and left aren't so obviously, you know, correct anymore. So it'll be an interesting time, but a challenging time, obviously, for the country. And I'm very open-minded about where, at least I won't speak for everyone else. I was about to say where we all end up, but I'll just say about where I end up.
No, I share that point of view. I just can't look. It's not that they want us back either. So I mean, I think it'll be knocking on your door.
Hey, yeah, right.
It will be a mutual separation. But yeah, there are some people that just like, okay, we're just kind of done there. But I do think there's the distinction with the local parties. At least there's a little glimmer of hope that we've seen more recently about that, and we'll see whether that persists. Bill Kristol, thank you so much for taking so much time to talk with us today. It's always good to have you back on the podcast.
Sure, hey,
can I just wallow for a moment on something?
Sure.
Since you and I are listed as, you know, co-founders of The Bulwark, you know, I was just struck yesterday. I was telling my wife, you know, don't take it for granted how successful this little publication has become in a year and a half. When you think of the footprint that The Bulwark has and what it's been able to accomplish, when basically we just threw this thing together on the fly in the days after the murder of the Weekly Standard, it's really kind of extraordinary, isn't it? I mean, just to step back and go, wow, with all the websites out there, there's no reason why we should really be punching above our weight to the degree that we are.
No, and I mean, I think you were great at you were really the key person at the founding, more than me. I tried to help out Tom, and Jonathan Last has been doing the day-to-day. I think you've been doing the podcast.
Sarah Longwell, terrific, putting it together.
But the number of people who, Sarah Longwell, who really helped put it all together and does continue to do so as publishers. So now I really think it's been fun for me and great to see and exciting. And the number of people I run into and who are reading it, who are willing to write for it. We have that piece by Lois Lowry up today, who's not
which is amazing.
Who any of us knew much personally. I think I might have met her once. And she seems to have decided that, you know, this is a good place to write something. I don't think she's written stuff before on the relationship. She's the author of these very famous children's books.
The Giver.
The Giver is the most famous, I suppose. And she discusses the relation of the current moment to that, the story of that book. And people should look at that. James Carville, was it just a week ago, I guess?
This week.
Out of the blue. I hadn't, you know, it's not like we've been propagandizing with James or anything like that. I mean, I know him slightly, but so people are reading it and across the country. I'm very, really proud of it. You should be proud of it. We should all be pleased that it's doing well. And it does show. I mean, so the good news, just to close on that, it does show there's some market for points of view that are not, on the one hand, Trumpist, obviously, but not, on the other hand, orthodox, left liberal, you know, everything will be great as soon as you know, we get kind of
non-tribal, non-tribal thinking. There's a market for it. Who knew?
That's encouraging. And on that encouraging note, let's enjoy your weekend, Charlie, since you're maintaining that distinction very admirably. I'll try to follow you in that.
All right, Bill. We will talk to you soon. And thank you all for listening to The Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back on Monday, and we will do this all over again.